You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Brewer. I'm with Ned Bolting.
Hello, Richard.
It's just me and Ned at the moment, but you'll be hearing in a little while from myself and Lionel Burney, who went to Manchester a few days ago to interview Sir Bradley Wiggins, mainly about the Hour Record and his new book, which is out, and we've got a signed copy of that book to offer as a prize. I'll think of a question in the next few minutes, or maybe you can think of a question, Ned, can you? Think of a question.
What, for to win the hour? All right, how far did Bradley Wiggins go in 1 hour?
Tweet it and hashtag Wiggins Hour. Hashtag Wiggins Hour. And tweet us at cycling_podcast with the distance that Bradley Wiggins covered. And somebody will be picked at random to win a signed copy of his book. Before we hear from Bradley Wiggins, Ned, we thought we should turn our attention briefly, maybe not that briefly, but for a few minutes at least, to the ongoing fallout from the release of Chris Froome's Power Data. We spoke about this last week. Lionel and I actually discussed it before the article was published on Friday. But we pretty accurately predicted, I think, what would happen, that Froome would release some data and people would digest that and find it interesting, I think, but then want more, inevitably. I think that's where we're at. But I was curious to hear what your thoughts were on it, what your reaction was to it.
I've genuinely always struggled to understand the significance of VO2 max in terms of the propriety of sport and what conclusions you can draw from this measurement. I struggle with the actual the way it's measured for a start, and perhaps, you know, Richard, having witnessed these tests, you could help me out with this, because I don't see how reliable it can possibly be, given that it seems to be limited by how hard the athlete wants to go in that certain test, in terms of you know what they're capable of. So, where is the control in that?
In quite an artificial environment. I saw some comments actually from Fred Grapp, the trainer at Francis de Jeux, who thinks that performance in the field, i.e. in a race, will be better. It would be better than in a lab, and I don't doubt that for a second. But the difficulty is in measuring that, of course. But that you know, we know that some athletes perform well in labs, or we know that some athletes don't perform well in labs, but do perform well on the road. Famously, Mark Cavendish was almost rejected for the British Cycling Academy on the basis of his lab test. He's not somebody who performs well in a lab test. He's somebody who performs well in a race, and so that surely does restrict or hamper the reliability, I suppose, the accuracy of some of these figures.
Not only that, and I've got to be really careful how I express this, because I don't want what I say to be even suggestive of any doubt in this in the case of Chris Froome. I have a great deal of faith in Chris Froome, and knowing the guy a little, I don't. But right. But if you are undergoing this series of tests, and one of the potential pitfalls you've got in PR terms of making this information public is if your VO2 max is deemed to be unusually high, right? Mm. Now, would it not therefore be in your interests when you're undergoing these independent tests just to pull up a little bit short of what you might have produced? And where is the motivation for going as deep as you possibly can to really find out your VO2 max?
Well, while he was doing the test, he couldn't see the figure. I was sitting behind standing behind the screen. I could see what his VO2 max was as it went up. It went up to 92.93, but it's taken over a 30-second period. That would be a very difficult thing to calculate, too low, and that would be suspicious. Too high, and that would be suspicious. So I don't know that you've got any choice other than to...
Which returns us to my central question of what is the point in knowing what someone's VO2 max is?
Well, it does all depend on how...
In terms of the propriety sort of argument. I understand if I'm looking to hire an athlete, I want to know what he's capable of, so it's a pretty good... That's good. So, you know, understanding that Mark Cavendish, you know, when he was tested, I understood why they were testing Mark Cavendish, even if, you know, they were led up the garden path by that. But what does it show? What does it prove?
It proves...
Suspicion either way.
It doesn't... I mean, let's be... absolutely blunt about it. Chris Froome did the test because people asked him to do the test. Yeah. There was a lot of that was the clamour was for Chris Froome to go and do a VO2 test. People wanted to know his VO2 max. Greg LeMond was one of those calling for him to do a VO2 test. That's what he's done. Of course, it's just opened up a whole series of other questions. But of course, and I think this is why teams, including Team Sky, don't do VO2 tests, because it's not the be-all and end-all. And even if the figure acquired in the lab is accurate, it doesn't determine who wins a race or who doesn't win a race. There's so much more to it. The I Am Cycling Pro, the American Larry Warbass, actually tweeted a series of tweets the other day pointing this out, which I thought was very interesting and right, that there's an awful lot more goes into winning a bike race than just having the physiological capacity. This is something we've obviously spoken at. As I said last week, I did record a lot of audio in the laboratory with Froome and with the scientists, and that will be a friend special. It'll be our first friend special of 2016. So there's a lot still to come on this. But I was curious to know your thoughts, Ned. Will it? You know, has it led to greater understanding or greater confusion? I suppose that's the question.
Well, I think part of the problem is it's just one, you know, it's one rider on one particular occasion. And, you know, what's very interesting in the piece that you wrote for Esquire, Richard, is the comparison between his, you know, his results as a kid in 2007. But until we've reached a position where all this information is made commonly and regularly available across a wide number of riders in the peloton from all sorts of different teams, in isolation, it's probably fairly fruitless. You know, he was pressured to do it. He did the right thing, I think, but I don't, you know, anyone who wants to sit back and on the basis of that particular article that you wrote draw conclusions either way is doing so erroneously, aren't they, really? I mean, it's just until after over a number of years you've built up a real picture of what VO2 max looks like, you know, out there in the field, and these tests are somehow, rather than, you know, one-off test being conducted in London in some GlaxoSmithKline, you know, this needs to be kind of, if we're going to do this, let's do it properly, and let's do it en masse and all jump together, because until we reach that point, I don't see the value in it.
One of the other aspects of it was there was a limited release of blood values from this year and from 2007, and again, of course, that led to the call for the release of more blood values. I watched Sebastian Coe last week in his select committee appearance, where he didn't give a great account of a lot of things, but I did feel that he was right when he was asked about athletes releasing their blood values. I think the problem with this is that if athletes release all of that kind of information, some of it sensitive medical information, and allow themselves to be scrutinized by everybody, I think one of the problems in the current sort of landscape is that there is often no distinction between an expert's opinion and a non-expert's opinion, and a lot of experts are self-appointed experts. And how do we know who's a expert and who's got an agenda? Things so easily now pass into fact or being considered as fact. There was a case on Saturday where somebody had tweeted a picture from the 2006 Commonwealth Games handbook, which showed Chris Froome's weight in 2006 as 68 kilograms. Mm. Somebody tweeted that. It got a lot of traction. The comment with it was, so, you know, funny how easy it is to be found out as a liar or something. But if you looked at the next line, it listed his height as 5'8", which is 5 inches less than his height now. And I don't think he has grown 5 inches in height. So, you know, The sort of scepticism that is required of journalists is not necessarily required of everybody, and often if people have a particular viewpoint, they're looking for evidence to back up that viewpoint and don't perhaps apply scepticism equally across the board or questioning.
Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. Although I would suggest, I mean, you're fundamentally talking about Twitter here, aren't you, and kind of people out there online. And I think it's remarkable when you're inside a bubble how much attention you pay to these disparate voices that are often not particularly constructive or nor informed. But actually, in the wider sort of context of how that particular athlete is viewed globally and in the broader sporting, you know, it takes an awful lot of those sort of voices to mount up to, for anything really to shift in terms of, maybe we saw a bit of that happening with the way that the French public reacted to increasingly to Team Sky and Chris Froome. So maybe some of that has kind of leaked out into the wider consciousness.
I think it does leak out. And I think that increasingly the media is influenced by that. And, and the media is very powerful.
That's the danger, isn't it?
I read an interesting article about Donald Trump and how little money he's put into his presidential campaign, but he's using social media, I don't know if in a consciously clever way, but in an effective way. Whereby it doesn't actually matter if what he says is true or not.
Yeah.
The fact that he says it carries some weight and has some resonance in those circles, and that filters out and the momentum builds up behind him and the truth is lost.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly, but it always but you always need this, I think you always need the stepladder of some mainstream media to kind of affect that, you know, that breakthrough moment for this kind of environment, I think.
Very good point. I think we're still talking about the Froome data. I'm not sure. We'll hear from Bradley Wiggins in a moment. But Ned, have you anything else been going on in the cycling? We're in the off season, but have you been doing anything else cycling related recently?
No, not really. It's a bit of darts for me at the moment. I think the next thing I'll be involved in, touch wood and cross fingers, they're just trying to work out what the broadcast schedule is, will be in January, and it'll be the Berlin 6 day, which I hope will be on the telly.
Great. Well, let's hear from mine and Lionel's conversation with Bradley Wiggins in Manchester now. So, Bradley, we've got your new book in front of us here, your latest tome. This is on the Hour Record, which we were at. What comes across? I mean, you obviously planned it meticulously. Everything had been thought about. It's probably the best planned Hour Record of all time. But on the night itself, what comes across in the book is that it was sort of unexpected to you that the early laps you found yourself maybe swept along a bit by the atmosphere and riding too fast, basically.
I think what I remember most about it was I had this, as I said to you in the days before, I had this distance in my head that I thought I was capable of doing, or I knew I was capable of doing. And I think, you know, there had a lot been made of the weather conditions, and I think battling that in the days before it, and even in the room similar to this, in the hour before it, sat in the final talks with Heiko and Shane Sutton, and just deciding on what gear, and we sort of got a final outcome of what the pressure was. And then I still in my head, kind of even in that first 5 minutes, I still had to go out and just have a feel of what that felt like. I didn't want to accept that I perhaps wasn't going to do 55-2 until I'd actually got up there and felt what it was like. And it was after 5 or 6 minutes I thought, okay, yeah, I'm going to have to accept that I'm going to have to probably come back to fives, which was 16 fives laps rather than 16 threes. And I knew that that would still give me 54.5. So I kind of gave away 700 metres to the weather. Mm. So that's still the only real overriding disappointment I have with the hour record, was that I was only ever going to do it once. And it's a shame that I didn't get the conditions, even 20 millibar difference, you know. Would have given me that 55.2 that I wanted. So it's a good record, but it's not unbeatable, and I think it will be broken within 3 years at the standard it's at now. But at the same time, I'm just glad that I got the record, and my name's on that list now with all the others. So
it's, I mean, as I said, you are someone who prepares meticulously for things. You like to know, you know, control the controllables. You like to know what's going to happen. So did it surprise you on the night? You know, you mentioned a few times that you were conscious of a girl screaming at one particular point in the lap. There are all these things that you can't really prepare for, even the atmosphere, the crowd, the temperature. You know, so how in that situation do you deal with that? Do you sort of get back to basics, to thinking about this is what I need to do?
Well, it's quite... I think because of the intensity of the effort in the first 10 minutes, it does feel easy. And you have to be careful that you don't end up going out too fast, because obviously it is an effort over 1 hour. So 10 minutes should feel relatively... If you had to stop at 10 minutes, you know, like the day before, we did a stand in 5 kilometres just on pace. And that's easy. That's 20 laps of what you can do for 1 hour. So you come off and go, God, that was easy, that, yeah. So the first 10 minutes, you have to be careful. You have to keep the back of the mind that this is 1 hour and it's not 10 minutes or 5 minutes. You know, you go out, you're on that power, you're on that lap split. So you are aware of a lot of other things because it is an easy effort. You find yourself drifting. You're not in this intense extreme because you realise that it is going to get harder. Much like an old King Cycle test for anyone who's done a King Cycle test back in the day. You know, it gets harder and harder and harder and you got to keep that little diamond thing in the middle of the... And you realise that it is going to get harder. So in some ways, you allow yourself a small amount of freedom. So when it starts biting, you're ready to dig in. So, you know, I say that the focus and the intensity after 2 minutes isn't the same as it is after 50 minutes. So, yeah, I did pick up on small things like this Cockney girl voice shouting at me coming into the home straight every lap. I can smell beer or I can smell hot food being cooked, or I just get a sort of blaze of pink shirts, which was the vitality thing going on in the middle. Or, you know, but after a while, you start forgetting about them things. You go, God, this is really starting to hurt now. So, you know, I think, yeah, and people wouldn't expect that, you know, that first, what it's like. And I think just trying to explain that, what it's like to do an hour record, really. And also summarise the history of the hour record, because I think people forget, people that are new to the sport, as a lot are, with the, you know, the boom in cycling the last couple of years, people didn't even know this record existed, as it lied dormant for 20 years after Chris broke it in 96. So reminding people the history and who's been for it and the riders that have held it before, I think is what my idea with the book was. Ideas, yeah.
You mentioned the history there. I mean, is there something about the hour record? It's a logical thing because, you know, it's a nice round unit of time, but physiologically, is there something a bit like the marathon is kind of that distance that's almost designed to be just beyond what is comfortable? Is the hour the same in cycling?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think it's too far for a lot of people to think about taking on. I think had it been a 20-minute record, Cancellara would have gone for it 10 years ago in his prime. You know, so I think it's one of those records that makes people think twice about going for it. And there's not many people, I sort of think, in modern-day cycling who will attempt this record as it stands. Now, obviously, we saw a lot of attempts since Jens because the record was put back to... was it put back to Moses' record or Boardman? No, Eddie Merckx, sorry, 49. So it's but obviously as the record gets more, less and less, there are less and less people that you think could do it. So yeah, it's one thing that hasn't changed with the hour record from Dot is the intensity and the effort and the focus that it takes to ride for 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
Positions have changed, aerodynamics have changed, training methods have changed. But I had a lovely book and a message from Baldini, who went for the record. And obviously, he went for it in a completely different setup, much like the Merckx setup. But here's someone who 40, 50 years ago did it, who knows exactly what it's like to do the hour record, who can still relate to in the modern day.
That was a great story in the book. Did he send you that note after and his book after your ride?
I can't remember. I think it was after. Mm. You know, like I say, it's a club, it's a special club that people, you know, Eddie Merckx, another one, you know, I had a chat with him in Qatar this year about it.
And you said in the book that Merckx, you spoke obviously about other people who might go for it, and he thought Tony Martin, though he clearly has the physiology and the physical ability, it's the track craft that you need, and his tendency to shift around on the saddle quite a lot might count against him. So there's more to it than just, you know, your Cancellara as well doesn't have a lot of track experience. Yeah. That's a big part of it.
I think you can get over that, though. I think that guys can get over that. I mean, Jens, I mean, you know, I know the record was 49 or 50 when he did it, but still, to do what Jens did at that age was incredible, really. And I think Tony Rominger fell off the track the first time he got on it. I mean, if you watch his 55-2 record, he sits down halfway through the banking because he gets scared out of the saddle. I mean, you know, once you're up and running, and someone like Tony, if he's going to do it, he'll do his homework with it, and he's got a great team of people behind him. I think the next one, certainly, I think Rowan will break it again at some point. He's got 10 years to break it. Is Tom Dumoulin, you know, he's another one who I think they may get in before Tony ever gets a chance to do it. So
I spoke to Alex Dowsett at the weekend about his effort, and I asked him about the comparison between the hour record on the track and an hour long time trial on the road, and he said that riding on the track gave him an appreciation of just how much rest you get in a road time trial of an hour.
It's relentless, absolutely relentless, and I tried to summarise that in the book. This feeling of kind of the way you ride a track is if you watched, if you looked at a speed trace on a track, you go faster in the banking because you're sort of going downhill essentially, and it's how you marry the power with that speed gain you get. So normally you press on further in the banking and just back off slightly in the straights, because if you pressed on the same in the straights as you do in the banking, you'd get a massive surge in power in the straights for where you don't get a lot of speed gain. So riding the track with that kind of I call it squeezing, because you're talking about 10, 12, 20 watts each time, so you're squeezing the power in the bankings to 450 watts back into 440 watts on the straight, 450 watts, and that continual for 220 laps, 440 times you've got to do that. If you sat on a table here for 1 hour with one of those old kids' toys where you plunge it down and it builds up speed and you kept plunging it, but when it gets to a certain speed, you've got to plunge it at the right point to gain more momentum, because if you just went at it, it wouldn't be, the ratchet thing doesn't work. So I described the hour record to much like, well, if you sat there for an hour just doing that and you had to do it right, that in itself would be hard work. So if you translate that onto a bike where you've got to squeeze, anyone who's ridden a turbo for an hour realize just how hard it is to hold a certain given power. You know, people could sit at 200, 250 watts. You take that up to 450 watts for an hour on a turbo trainer. It's tough work. And then, you know, the first thing that happens on a turbo when you start fatiguing, you change up a gear and you start pushing more. So your cadence to 80. On the track, you don't get that beauty. So you're 106, 107 RPM the whole time. So it's unforgiving on the track. It really is.
So that the specialism of riding on the track and the requirement of the training and the effort of actually doing it, do you think that makes it much harder for riders who are currently focused on the road to go for it?
Yeah, because I don't... it's a completely... Although physiologically it's the same sort of effort, it's about riding threshold for 1 hour. The demands are higher in that you can't change gear, so gear selection is everything. We wanted it at 28 degrees. We set the building at 28 degrees. Then you put 6,000 people in, it went up to 33. Mm-hmm. We can't stop halfway through and go, actually, it's too hot. Can you just turn the heating down a bit? So you've got to get all these things right before it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you look at someone like Thomas Dekker, who went for it in Colombia. I mean, that was sort of unexpected, the distance he produced. But, you know, he's kind of, the trace of his ride was like a roller coaster. So, you know, that pace judgment, and, you know, Alex was a prime example of that, someone who started within himself and finished strong. And you know, on paper you'd say, had he ridden a flat line, he would have gone a lot faster. So, but you only get one shot at it on that day. Obviously, you can do it again. So it's about just knowing what you set. So doing your homework, knowing what you're setting yourself up for on the day.
Well, you clearly did your homework, but you also learned an awful lot from doing it, things that you couldn't have anticipated. And you mentioned Tim Kerrison obviously had an input into the training, but perhaps doesn't have the track experience. So you sort of tweaked his training a little bit, but you've learned so much that it leads to the question, you know, and you hint at it in the book. Would you do it again? You hint at maybe the athlete's hour.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to do it again, but I just don't think I'm going to have the time to do it again at the moment with Rio. So, you know, a relatively short time away. I think if I was doing it again next year on the same date, knowing what I know now, having done it, I wouldn't do it in London for a start. You know, but historically, that area...
That Cockney girl so off-putting, was she?
No, just where that is on the map, London, in that area, is historically, the pressure is always quite high there. Manchester, I think, is a faster track, and you get a lot more days of low pressure. And I'd probably do it a different time of year as well. But, you know, I had to pick a venue 7 months out, and I thought, well, I've never ridden the track in London. It's the Olympic track. I started racing at Eastway when I was a kid. I'd love to go back there. You can fit the most people in that. So from a commercial point of view, it was the best place to do it. And so we did it, and I've done it now, and it's there, and it's in history. So I think hindsight's a wonderful thing.
It just strikes me that you're quite an unusual mix of, you know, being very pragmatic and dialed in and programmed, but also having this real romantic streak. I mean, you talk in the book about you stayed in a hotel and so on, you rode every day at Regent's Park. You know, how do you marry these two very sort of opposing things?
I don't know. I've always done that. I think they complement each other, because I don't think I'd be the athlete today without my love and history of the sport that I have. Because at the end of the day, that inspiration that I got from all these riders, you know, whether it's having a picture with Johan Museo in a Belgium hotel and being overjoyed that he's given me his Belgium national champs jersey, and that takes me back to my 16 years of age, you know, and the inspiration I used to get from someone like him, watching him, or Indurain when he was there at the hour, I wouldn't be where I am today, because that is why I wanted to do it, you know. And I know there's a lot of controversy now in cycling with these past names and things, but I wasn't thinking that when I was 16, and you know, it's kind of in some ways they're the reason why I'm
so how I guess have you retained that love of the romance?
Well, it kind of went away for a long time in the middle of my career, and I ended up sort of despising the sport in many ways around 10 years ago, sort of 2006-07, and I was just doing it, and I had other things in my life that I really focused on, like children and stuff, and I used to just think, well, this, you know, I'm doing this is a job at the end of the day, and I enjoy doing it, I enjoy training, but used to get frustrated with so many other things. And then I think as I got older and I got into the prime of my career and passed the Tour de France bit, and I'd achieved what I'd wanted to achieve, or more than what I ever thought I'd be capable of achieving, that then I started looking back and become a lot more nostalgic with it. And I suppose it's a natural thing as well, when you know you're coming to the end as well, or the last few years, that you start looking back, and I start thinking, God, yeah, that's 12, 15 years ago I was riding with Jackie Durand and these guys, and the sport has changed so much. But at the same time, I kind of, cycling has given me everything, and I wouldn't be where I am today without that inspiration I had as a kid and the love I had for cycling, you know, plastered pictures all over my walls, as a lot of people are, you know.
It's funny, a lot of people, you know, retire having fallen out of love with it. Yeah. You seem to have fallen back in love with it.
Yeah, gone the other way, you know. I mean, I had wet myself 2 weeks ago. Eddie Merckx wrote me a handwritten letter inviting me to this Roulin thing last week. And it was, you know, just things like that still.
Yeah.
You know, I get a bit starstruck with it. And like Indurain being at the hour record, you know, things like that. Just, I always bring it back to like this kind of, I always said, you know, I won the Tour de France, which, you know, pinch myself sometimes. But when I was a kid, you never had, you weren't, the kids, like little skinny white kids from Kilburn weren't supposed to win the Tour de France. We used to sit on the turbo watching videos of the Tour de France, like Indurain climbing with Mechir and all these guys, and then like Robert Miller attacking, and he was the only one, him and Sean Yates, and then Chris Bourbon came along, and these guys that used to win these things, they were from other climates, and you didn't have internet then, or it was just started, you didn't have social media. Cycling Weekly was the sort of only outlet. You used to go and get that on a Thursday and read what the results were and things, so you couldn't, it wasn't as accessible to go and find that sort of stuff, that information. Now you can just click on it within minutes, you've got a story. But it was,
you mentioned the book, the Indurain, I think, went for the hour record on a Friday, and you didn't discover till the following Thursday that he'd broken it.
Well, no, because he didn't know. Yeah. He had to wait until Thursday.
So you mentioned also in the book your son Ben has got quite into cycling. He has two heroes, Peter Sagan and Bradley Wiggins, but that's not Bradley Wiggins' father. It's Bradley Wiggins, the cyclist. And he's obviously keen on the sport. How would you feel about him getting into the sport?
Yeah. I think he couldn't be getting into it at a better time now. You know, the sport is where it's at today, but, you know, another 10 years or 8-10 years when he's 20 and Neo Pro or whatever, if it keeps going where it's now, the sport's going to be worlds apart. And I think all this sort of talk of Lance and the post-Lance era, and you're going to have likes of Chris Froome by then, will be retired, have won however many tours he's won, done it clean and proven that, and there's no scandals, then that's what it needs, is these kind of people, a lengthy period of time with no scandals and people to look up to. So I think it's going to be, the sport will be in a much better place by then. And like I say, cycling's given me everything, and I don't see why he could be doing worse things.
How do you kind of, you know, interact with Ben when he's into cycling? I mean, it must be quite difficult. You know, he's your son.
Mm.
You've got to be dad rather than Bradley Wiggins. You know,
well, I think you just do it. You just do it without thinking about it. I don't think you think. I'd never think about those things. The only thing I try and do is portray the amount. Well, they know that the amount of love I have for cycling. You know, they're all just in the house is bikes, old jerseys, things. You know, it's just sort of in their blood. They've not known anything else, really. So I think it's... you just do it. You just live your life. You don't really think about it while you're doing it. You just... who you are, and you portray that to them, and you are, you know, you're a product of your childhood at the end of the day, and you don't try and do anything different. You just try and be yourself and instill your own morals, and that's why kids either turn out good or bad, depend on what their parents are like. So I don't think you think about those things. You're not aware of it at the time. You just live in it, and all of a sudden 10 years has gone by and you're like, oh shit, I'm 36 now.
Back to sort of putting the prep into the hour record, how could you compare it or contrast it to preparing for the Tour de France, and particularly in terms of like putting your little team together for this particular objective?
In some ways, yeah, but I think in some ways it was a lot easier because it's just it's so quantifiable. It was like, right, well, what's 50, I mean, when we started this project, what's 53 kilometres? That's 17 second laps. Right, okay, let's try that for 10 minutes. Oh, that felt all right. Should we go to 16:8? Try that for 20 minutes. So it's just, there's no, right, how are we going to avoid this rider? You know, he's a nightmare in the first week of the Tour de France. What if he knocks you off and you go home? Right, we've got to get through this first week, you know. You're going to have to stay in the front all day when every team's thinking. So it's so different in that. This is just like power for an hour and you'll get this distance. So in some ways, I like that. I like that because that gave you the initial answers. Do you think you can do it? Well, yeah, I can, because I've just done 420 watts for 40 minutes there, and that will give me this distance. If I'd carried on for another 20, I would have broke the hour record in training. There you go. So it sounds, and you end up sounding quite not arrogant. I mean, some people might feel you're bullish over it. When you said, like, someone asked me straight away after Alex broke it in Yorkshire, do you think, what does that change anything for you now? I was like, well, not really, because I did 45 minutes last week at 53.5, so I think I can still do it, and there's more to come. I've got a month to go. And it's such a quantifiable record like that, you know. It's just it's like running, or, you know, it's if someone, you know, the mile record or whatever. It's just you need to do this lap time or whatever. So I think from that point of view, it was a lot easier because you knew what to expect. There was not, it wasn't that much of a lottery. I mean, when I look back to the Tour de France, obviously I crashed out in 2011, probably could have gotten the podium that year. So going into 2012, it was just like, you know, I've won every race this year. I know I can win this race, but just got to get through all this rubbish for the next 3 weeks, really. So in that respect, it's a hell of a lot easier.
So in terms of sort of the wider sporting world, it strikes me it's a bit like a sort of heavyweight boxing title fight with yourself as the opponent.
Tyson Fury, like last week, just like that, wasn't it, really?
You know, I've been joined by Tyson Fury.
He kept saying he knew he could do it.
Yeah. But in the sense,
I know I can beat Vladimir Klitschko. You know, just all he kept saying. But he knew he had to come through those first eight rounds or whatever, and he knew he'd just keep picking him off. So it's a lot. Many sports you can sort of draw the comparison that it's just that process, going through that process. You know that once you get to that point, you'll be able to unleash. And that was the same. I said it in my time, the other book, was the Tour de France for me was just about getting open road. So getting through all the mayhem of that first week and getting to that Planche de Belfield. And then we knew that once we were on the front of the peloton, that the physical side of the tour would take shape. So, you know, we'd be fitter than everyone else. Everyone would fall by the wayside, which happened, took the jersey. Then it was staying safe through the next, get to that next time trial, extend the lead. So it was always about just getting open road. And the hour record was open road from the start. So there was nothing to come through. No kind of, the only thing we were fighting against was the weather, you know. But I always felt I had enough in hand. I always said I think I could put the record out of sight based on what I've done. And I always had enough in hand to just give a little bit away to the weather. It's not like we were, you know, Alex was going on the record. So he had a couple of metres either way, got to 40, 50 minutes and realised I felt great here. So he, you know, extended it. We weren't going on Alex's record. We were going on Rominger's. And we could afford to give a bit away to the weather, which still gave us 2 kilometres in hand. Mm. So it was a different scenario to the one that Alex went against.
Sorry, I was going to ask about Team Wiggins, because you talk about Team Wiggins well and your longer-term ambitions. You seem to enjoy being part of that setup, helping Owen Doole at the Tour of Britain. And you talk about, you know, maybe taking that team to the Tour de France one day. How would that happen? Would you be looking for a sponsor for that?
Yeah, or? I mean, I don't know if I want to do that, if I'm honest. The Tour, I mean, they saw the Tour this year. It's just, it's changed the tour. I don't know if it's changed for the better, and I haven't decided whether it's changed for the better or the worse. But at the same time, there was some real success stories in the tour this year. I mean, MTN Quebec, where what they've come, what they represent. The fella, forget his name, sorry, excuse me, the guy who took the King of the Mountains.
Daniel Tecklahaymanot.
Daniel. You know, that was a success story. Not only that, was groundbreaking in cycling, I think. You know, that's phenomenal, really. And then Steve Cummins win. And then you took at the other, you know, the people that loved that, that sort of romance of the sport. And they, you know, and then you looked at the other end of the spectrum, what Team Sky went through. I mean, that's horrible. I don't think anyone... Is that now... what's going to happen to whoever's leading the Tour de France for the next few years? I don't know. I mean, it's not a nice thing to watch, or I don't think anyone can take pleasure in watching that. So I think, I don't know with the Tour. I'm undecided with that. But then I take it right back to grassroots and that, and then something like Owen, the success story of watching Owen flourish and do things like that. And then going on to, I think it's no secret, he's going to turn professional after the Olympics. That's a success story for this team, and I'd love to see more riders do that. The likes of, I forget his name now, the lad we got next year in the team. He's come from the British Academy, Scott Davis. I just think that there's, for me, aside from the British Cycling Academy, that there's no natural pathway for a road rider who doesn't ride the track to come through in order without going to America, as Teo's done. And gone through Axel's system. That system, the amount of professionals it's produced, is fantastic. But I'd love there maybe to be something here, like a... And if that's the legacy of me winning the Tour and having this career, I would love that to build on that. But not only put guys in the pro ranks or go on to win the Tour de France and stuff, but giving people a chance that perhaps wouldn't normally get given a chance, you know, and be in that team, really. So, I mean, we've got... guys like Dan Patton, who's a bit of a stalwart the last few years, and he's just loving life on the team, going off to Belgium every week racing. He's been an incredible success story of the team again, you know, someone who's, it was teamless, you know, didn't get any opportunities elsewhere, but loves cycling, just loves racing and getting stuck in, and he's come on board here, practically does it for nothing, and he's loving it. So I think, again, guys that wouldn't really get the chance, and I'd have to think carefully about, if we went to the Tour de France, what would our purpose be? Would it be to win the Tour de France? I don't know if I want that pressure and that kind of, you know, it'd be like Jose Mourinho, you know, trying to have this team like Davies, you know. I mean, just, I don't think I want to live that life, really. I mean, I don't know how they do it. It's tough there at the top. And, you know, I think with that, being at the top now, comes all this kind of extra pressure now in cycling. And I think... there has to be another purpose, I think, really, much like MTN Quebec have done.
So, Bradley, just looking ahead a bit, the hour record was the big focus for 2015. At Rio, the big focus for 2016. As we head towards Christmas, how are you set at the moment?
Good, yeah. I mean, we're working hard. We're in the gym three or four times. I'm trying to put a lot of weight on at the moment to cope with the track and what, you know, the demands of the track. And we won the Europeans six weeks ago now. And we're just in that sort of day-in, day-out, mundane training phase at the moment, really, which is three times a week in the track, bits and pieces on the road, but track, gym predominantly at the moment, which is a lot different to what I've been used to in the past of being out in all weathers at this time of year. So it's for me, I said a few times today already that I'm quite fortunate that I've been able to chop and change, and it's like a new challenge again. It's like being... I'm training with all these 21-year-olds at the track, and, you know, kind of... It's like I was 15 years ago getting ready for Sydney, really, and it's been nice coming back into that environment and having a complete change of everything and refreshing, and that's what's kept the motivation and the hunger there has gone back to the team pursuit. So I've just been enjoying it again now, and I'm really questioning whether I'm going to stop now next year.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask, do you think beyond Rio?
I've already said that I want to carry on racing to the end of the year next year, because I'd love to do Ghent, I'd love to do London 6, and whatever else is on, maybe go back to the Tour of Britain rather than just stop in Rio and, you know, get fat for 4 months. I think at the moment I just am loving it that much that I'll carry on racing till the end of the year, and I don't know, into the new year. I don't know, unless I've got a job by this time next year, I don't know, I just have to carry on racing.
Well, what will you do once you stop cycling? Do you think about that?
Well, there's a lot of things in the pipeline. I mean, I've obviously got I'm quite into the grassroots of it all, really. And I think kids in cycling, really, I mean, like kids' bikes, kids' clothing, anything to do with kids, really. Just not necessarily coaching, but this team, I think that's going to be enough taking up of my time, because I, at the end of the day, I want to keep cycling myself, whether I'm racing or not. So I don't want to be going off working at Tesco stacking shelves all night, because I want time to be getting out on my bike myself, because I will always cycle, you know, I still love it. So, yeah.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
So you heard there our extended Trainer Road jingle. We're still, there was a little Trainer Road update last week. You heard from Coach Chad Timmerman.
How's it going? How's your training going?
Well, can you not tell, Ned? Look at me. Yeah. I don't look svelte.
Yeah, no. Yes. Sveltish.
It's the dark colours, I think. No, it's going pretty well. I'm enjoying it a lot. I think we're all feeling the benefits from it, but we're at a point now where we're having an easy week, and we've got to do another FTP test, threshold test, in the next week or so. So our figures will be out there. Lionel was going to release his figures on Friday night, the day of the Froome data release. He thought that would be a good day to bury bad news, but yeah. I don't think he did do that.
Yeah. Yeah, like Seb Coe happened to have his select committee hearing at exactly the same time that in the other chambers they were debating the...
I'm going to try and anticipate a major media event for the release of my latest figures, but I'll be doing that test soon. Rob Hatch is doing it as well. And yeah, we're going to carry on with that for the next couple of months.
See what this looks like on the bike with you. And I suggest that you come down to our old farts session at Herne Hill Velodrome on Wednesday morning. What are you doing on Wednesday morning?
I'm busy on Wednesday morning washing my hair.
Are you? 8:30 till 10:30. You up for it?
It's usually when I wash my hair on a Wednesday. But we are planning to go to Herne Hill and do a 4 kilometre pursuit match, the three of us, in March, to see, just to see the effects of the training, because we all started off at kind of the same level of fitness, so it'll be interesting to see what effect it's had on each of us.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah,
so you can be there as a supporter or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all for this week, really. It was mainly taken up by the Bradley Wiggins interview. A reminder that you can win a copy of his book, just tweet the distance that he covered in his hour record, hashtag, I've forgotten what the hashtag was, Wiggins Hour. Wiggins Hour. And we'll pick somebody at random to win a signed copy of his book. We've got Friends Special number 11 coming up soon. That was our event at Lord's, where we offered an alternative review of the year. And we'll be back next week with Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney. And that's all today, though, from myself and Ned. Thank you very much, Ned.
Pleasure, Richard. An absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.